Hey, Leanne Dalton, and welcome to the Tick Bootcamp podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I'm really excited to have you for a whole host of reasons, the most important of which, quite frankly, is one of our favorite people happens to be your daughter, who's going to be a co-interviewee. But this interview is not going to be about Claire Dalton, because if folks want to learn about Claire, at least the young Claire from 2019, you can go to episode 41 of the Tick Bootcamp podcast, because Claire was one of our earliest guests. She has all grown up now, but we're still not going to revisit Claire's story, unless, of course, it does have some impact on the way that Leanne tells her story. So, Claire, welcome to the Tick Bootcamp podcast for like the 10th time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich. I'm so thrilled to be here. And I'm really glad that my mom feels ready to tell her story because in our house, we joke that mom, her nickname is the real MD. And that stands for Mom Deluxe because what happens when there's a threat to a mother's child? Well, she puts on her mama bear. And that's what happened when I got sick with Lyme disease. Mom put on her mama bear and she did everything she could to get me and herself well. So I'm really thrilled to be here and really thrilled to be able to share mom's story.
Well, thank you. So, Mom Deluxe. All right. So, I now even know your nickname, and we're just newly friends. So, Leanne, why don't you say hi to the folks and give them a little background? Meaning, why don't you share with folks where you grew up and a little bit about your current situation.
I am 65 years old. I have been married to my husband for 44 years. We just celebrated our 44th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We had a family of six children, three boys and three girls, and we have numerous grandchildren. And my husband and I are entrepreneurs. We started up in our 30s, we started our own business, and we did it together, and it became successful. And that is what has sustained us through this journey as well. And when I got sick, my sons took over the business, so it continues to sustain us. I was born in Colorado. I grew up in Denver, and I was very until age 12. I was a very active child. I, did normal things that kids did. I rode bikes. I was a swimmer. I was a junior lifesaver before I was 10 years old. I spent a lot of time swimming. I was in the mountains a lot. And the reason for that was because in 1920, my grandfather had bought some cabins up above Boulder, Colorado. And originally he bought them because he was the dean of Colorado University's medical school. And he was the head of their research department doing animal research at Colorado University. So originally he bought the cabins as a way to get away. But in later years, my grandmother would take the kids out of the cities because of the polio epidemics that happened after World War I. So she would go up and they'd spend all their summers. So my dad and his siblings spent all their summers up there. And then that continued as a tradition in our family. And that's where the ticks came in.
All
So
right, so you have family members who were active in the academic community, academic professionals, and use some of their money to buy some property as a getaway and to maybe isolate a little bit from the polio epidemic. You avoid one set of microbes for another set of microbes, not knowing that you were going to be exposed to ticks and tick diseases. So I'm assuming, based on the timing of this event in your life, you were not aware of ticks, and you were not aware of how to keep yourself safe from ticks, and you certainly weren't aware of what a tick bite would do to you, because that's decades before Lyme disease was at least publicly known and available to us as a diagnosis.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true.
All
So
right.
when we were in the mountains, for whatever reason, my mother was definitely afraid of ticks. She knew that they were there, and so when we'd come in at night, and of course, in those days we had to run of the mountain, so we were out all day long. And when we came in, we would have our nightly tick check, and that was just normal. So for I don't know why she knew that. She was from Indiana, so I don't know if that's because the antics there, but I suspect it was because of my grandfather and the research that he was doing at Colorado University. And so they knew that there was dangerous ticks. But a little disclaimer here is we still did not have ticks in Colorado the way you have them in New York. So it was still very rare that you found a tick. But there was one experience in my life where we'd gone up and we'd been up there for a while. And then when we came back down the next day, we went swimming. And in those days, you wore the ugly rubber swimming caps, and you were all required to wear those. And my mom made me get out of the water and took off the cap, and there was a big tick on the top of my head, and it was engorged with blood. So it was a lot bigger. And she gasped because she'd always been, very meticulous about checking us. And so she'd missed this one, and she felt really terrible. And in those days, everybody smoked. My mom smoked. And so she got a cigarette from somebody and, put it on the back of the tick. And I'm not saying that's what you should do now, but that's what they did in the old days. And they stuck it on the backside of the tick, and he backed his way out. And then we forgot about it. I mean, we didn't think about it anymore. But for some reason, those kind of memories are just kind of burned in your head, literally.
Maybe the
So
cigarette burned your head.
yeah, maybe. But I mean, I just won't forget that. But so when I first got sick with, was diagnosed with Lyme, I just went back to that. That had to be the moment, because it'd probably been on my head for a couple of days.
Okay. So let's I want to visit some of this in a little bit more detail. Because I'm intrigued first about your grandfather, who was a medical researcher, and what kind of research was he doing, and why was everybody so concerned about ticks long before Lyme disease had been allegedly discovered by Dr. Burgdorfer?
Well, there's a PubMed article that tells you that by 1930, that Colorado tick fever, they knew that ticks carried diseases in the Rocky Mountain states, which is interesting because, when I got Lyme disease, we're told that there is no Lyme disease in our state. But by 1930, they knew that there was Colorado tick fever. But by 1944, which was when my grandfather was the dean of that school, they were actually doing experimental type research where they actually were infecting people, volunteers, they said, with Colorado tick fever for whatever reason. I guess if they already knew that there was Colorado tick fever in the ticks, I don't know why they were experimentally giving them to people, but they were doing those kind of experiments. So, and the universities, my grandfather was connected to Yale. He was a Yale graduate, and he was the head of the research department for since 1916. So they were doing a lot of different kind of experiments. And I'm not even sure exactly what they were doing, but my grandfather did die of an illness that was a mysterious illness that had a lot of Lyme symptoms. Like by the time he was in his 70s, he couldn't walk very well. He would have to sit. He was very light sensitive. So as a little girl, I remember sitting in the parlor with him, and it had to be dark. It was always dark, and there were just a lot of things, and nobody would ever talk about what grandfather died of. But he had divorced my grandmother during World War II, and so there was a lot of bad blood in the family, and so I didn't, I was little, I was under 10, so I didn't really know, what he was doing. But his parents and my grandmother's parents both came from Connecticut, and my great grandparents, my great grandfather was some of the original. He was one of the original people that built some of the homes in Lyme, Connecticut, and so my great grandmother, because I have all her papers and all of her, even some of her journal, she had, by the time my grandmother was a young woman and having children of her own, she was pretty much bedridden with a very severe illness. And in the letters, they talk about how bad it was. She couldn't go to her daughter's to see her daughter have children. She couldn't go to her graduation. There was just, and they never knew what it was. And my great grandfather, as a child, who had grown up in that area, had been, as a child, had some paralysis, kind of polio type paralysis, and he'd been in a wheelchair. And they actually did for him, and he describes this, they did the Spanish fly blister treatment. And so they exposed you to being bitten by Spanish flies, which caused these awful blisters to come on your body, and then the blisters would pop, and then somehow that was the treatment for his paralysis. And I don't understand how that was the treatment, but he wrote about that in his journals and how extremely painful it was and how difficult it was. So at the very least, my family was very into medicine. There were many doctors in that line, and they were all acquainted with the medicines that they were using at that time. And so, and then my own father's family, the siblings that grew up, my dad suffered from a sciatica, like I do, from Lyme. My dad had a tremor, but my dad was a smoker, and that's another part of the story down the road. But he had a tremor his whole life. He had trouble sleeping, and when he died of a septic joint, which is not unusual for people with Lyme disease either. But my dad, because he'd had a run-in with my father, would never go to the doctor. So the only thing my dad would do was get a flu shot, because in 1918, when the big flu epidemic occurred, my dad got very, very sick and almost died during the, he was two in the flu epidemic. And that happened right after World War I. And so they continued to get flu shots through the years because of that fear of the flu. So his brother died of, well, he had epilepsy his whole life and had seizures his whole life, which was part of our journey too. Claire and I both had seizures, only he took epilepsy medicine. He was a doctor himself. So he took medications for that for years and years and years and never really got over that. And then their other brother had chronic arthritis type symptoms. He would have, just like what I have, that he would have to take three showers, hot showers a night, just to make it. And he stayed up in the mountains. He was a mining engineer, and he was up in the high altitudes, and so he had a lot of inflammation from high altitudes. There's just so many connections to my family
Yeah, so Leanne, I
to
mean, I'm sure if Claire were talking with some of her friends, she would say, your family sounds very limey.
Something like that. Except
Yeah.
I've lost a lot of my friends in this illness.
Yeah.
That's the minor problem there.
So Leanne, I'd like your reaction to one of the frameworks we talk about here at Tick Boot Camp, right? Here at Tick Boot Camp, we argue that there are upstream and downstream ways of contracting Lyme disease. Of course, the upstream is getting bitten by a tick.
Right.
Downstream, of course, would be congenital Lyme, where Lyme disease is passed from mother to child congenitally. There, of course, is the capacity to get Lyme disease through sexual transmission. And then the third is through blood transfusions. And as I'm listening to your family history, which, as I said, sounds very limey, it sounds to me that you had the likelihood of being exposed to Lyme disease in a lot of different ways. So I'm wondering whether or not you think that tick bite that you described to us from the engorged tick when you were 12 is really, in fact, the trigger for your illness. Was it something that exacerbated your illness, or do you have some other theories about how the limey history of your family tree impacted first you and then your daughter Claire?
Yeah, so there's no question that Lyme's carry that, excuse me, that ticks carry Lyme disease, okay? Or they carry microbes, they carry pathogens. They
A lot of bugs, a lot of bugs in the bug.
yeah. There's no question about that. And there's no question, I mean, obvious that there are things that can be passed down, but epigenetics is really what it's all about. So you have these predispositions to certain things. But then it depends on what you're exposed to, and And the things that we're not talking about very often is, what about all those things in the drugs that you are being given as your treatments or your med, like even the Spanish fly treatment, you know, what was that all about? And why did they think that that was a remedy? And so the only thing we don't address is, what about the pathogens that are coming through some of the other things that we are doing for actual treatment? And that is where, you know, I believe my story has led to. So yeah, all those things contributed, and we had predispositions to that, obviously, but I believe there was more to the story.
Okay, so let's break that down a little bit, and I'm going to want you to share that element of your story. But we do know that people have been getting bitten by ticks as long as there are people.
Sure.
Humans have been coming in contact with Lyme disease as long as you know, the Lyme bacteria or the Borrelia. Okay. For as long as they've been humans, right? We know that from, for example, here at the American Museum of Natural History, we have fossils that contain ticks that have been tested to have, Borrelia, which are millions of years old. We know that the oldest human, or I should say the earliest human that we've tested, which is 3,500 years old, Etsy the Iceman, had Lyme disease, right? So we know we've been coming in contact with this for all of our history. And we therefore know that we have, immune protections built into our system. So give me your thoughts on, you started to touch on epigenetics, and, you know, we started to use some of these really sciencey terms, but I'd like to break it down and ask you, Leanne, specifically about your theory and the distinction between coming in contact with these microbes and ultimately becoming sick from the microbes, and how that process, in your view, develops generally, and how you think it developed in your family.
Well, I think it all has to do with your immune system. So the world that I grew up in is a totally different world than Claire grew up in. And even the difference between her older brother, who is 17 years older than she is, and her world is a totally different world. And so
how is that significant? How is that significant, Leanne?
Because our immune systems are now being hit with dirty water, dirty air, genetically modified food. You know, Claire is the only one of my children that really was completely genetically modified food. I mean, that's when it began, was right before she was born. And so she didn't have, you know, the kind of nutritional foundation that my other kids had, or even I had. And it's a totally different world. And so that hits our immune system, and it's all about how strong your immune system is. So in a perfect world, our immune system would be able to deal with Lyme microbes, I believe. But we're not living in that kind of world anymore. And not only that, vaccinations have changed that as well. So Claire, out of all of my children, had a whole different vaccination schedule than my other kids did. And, you know, we started out with my other kids with having like 6 vaccinations, but Claire can tell her story about her experience with getting some vaccines when she was only like 6 years old.
But, yeah, you want me to tell that now? Okay. Yeah, so I mean, you know, you really look at the decline in health amongst young people, and you can definitely see, like, you know, when my brother was going to school, my oldest brother, who's in his 40s now, it was a lot different in the sense that, number one, he didn't get as many vaccines as I got. But number two, like, by the time I was going to high school, everybody was pushing the psychosomatic drugs. Oh, you're depressed. Oh, you have anxiety. Oh, you really need to be taking happy pills. Happy pills is what you need to do. And, you know, that's not something that my older siblings really experienced too much. And so there became this big drive to get on happy pills in my generation. And I'm sure that's even worse now with kids in high school now. And so, you know, what happened to me when I was 6 is we went in for my just childhood vaccinations that you go in for so you can go to public school and all these things. And I remember that I got 6 vaccines all in my hips all at the same time. And we even went back when I was really sick and we checked my old vaccine record. And I really believe those vaccines changed my life because that's where all of my health problems are. So my hips, my legs, my reproductive system, that's where all of it is centered. And so I know that those changed my life because I was never the same. And the doctors always just told me, well, you probably just have stomach ulcers or something like that. And then as I got older and it was more reproductive issues, they were like, well, you probably just have ruptured ovarian cysts a lot. And you know, that's just normal, but they still didn't really know. But after going on this really long journey, and realizing that it started there, my health started plummeting there. I was never a normal kid. It really connected a lot of dots for us. And so that kind of was even the beginning of figuring out where it even started with mom as well.
Okay, so Leanne, let's talk a little bit more about this issue, because there really are, I think, some formulaic conversations we can have about what has happened over time, right? So your family sounds limey going back to the 20s, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so even though we had less immunosuppressive chemicals and vaccinations and whole foods in our lives, your family was still getting sick, right?
Yeah.
But something has changed. And so let's talk about that. So, we here at Tick Boot Camp talk about risk all the time, and we use the General Stanley McChrystal formula for risk, which is, in this case, the risk of getting sick from Lyme disease or chronically ill from Lyme disease. Risk is defined as threat times vulnerability, right? So what is the threat and what is the vulnerability that's going to result in you ultimately becoming chronically ill? And I think we should talk about each prong separately, because I think you're touching on both, but I want to talk with you about both. So let's first talk about the threat, or the microbe or microbes that are going to be spit into you if you are bitten by a tick, or you ultimately become ill from a downstream contact with Lyme disease. And is it your opinion that the threat was just as great for your ancestors, your pre-World War II ancestors, as it is now for someone your daughter's age, both from the standpoint of the likelihood of being bitten by a tick and the likelihood of being bitten by a tick that will have microbes that will overwhelm her immune system?
I don't believe that the way that you get the microbes from a tick is only through a tick bite.
Okay.
So, I don't believe that. So
help us with that.
So let me just share what I believe my trigger was.
Okay.
So in 1971, my parents had moved from Colorado and we went up to Northern Idaho. And in Northern Idaho, we were in wooded areas too. The backyard was the forest. And it's beautiful. Northern Idaho is beautiful. But I actually do not remember ever encountering a tick in Northern Idaho. So that doesn't mean they're not there. That wasn't a part of our worries or concerns when we lived up there. But in 1971, I went to school and I got a childhood shot. And it wasn't the first one that I'd gotten at school. In our day, they used to line you up at school and give you your childhood immunizations at school. And the worst ones of these were the injector guns. So they would give you a shot, and it had no needle. It was a gun.
And just a little context for everybody here, these injector guns, they shoot this substance into your child's arm at 1200 PSI. So we own a monument company and we engrave headstones, so rock, at 100 PSI. So to give you some context and some idea, they're shooting your children with this substance at 1200 PSI, which is a lot. And then we wonder why all these kids are crying in line as they're getting their injector gunshot.
Yeah, and they used it not just for kids at schools, although I can't even find any evidence of that anymore, but I had several in that way. So they also used it in the military, and you would have to put the gun straight up to the person's arm, and you'd have to not flinch, but you'd be standing in line at school and all these kids are bawling. I mean, a lot of us are bawling because we don't want this. And then the person would tell you, now don't move, don't move. But they're blasting it into your arm at 1200 PSI and it makes a loud pop. And then this blood trickles down your arm, and then they wipe you up, and then the next person comes along. And in later years, they actually found out that there were military men that actually sued and found out that those injector guns were transmitting HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B. And the reason for that was because it would damage the tissue, and then basically, if they didn't clean up the gun right, and sometimes it would back up into the gun, then the next person got a nice dose of whatever the last person had. And they actually, won some of those trials that they proved that that was actually happening with the injector guns. They're actually talking about bringing the injector guns back. But we just wanted to let you know that was the barbarous practice that they were practicing at that time with little kids. And so I got this shot, and it was one of the first MMRs. And I had to go to an after-school activity over at the elementary school. I was in junior high by sixth grade. And when I was walking over there, I felt odd. I was starting to get dizzy. I started to lose my vision. I was starting to break out in a sweat. I didn't feel good. And then when I got there, the teacher canceled the practice. And there were no cell phones in those days. And so she locked the school, and I was a bus kid. So I had to wait for my dad to get there. There was no way to call him or anything. It was raining, and I got so sick that I lay down on the pavement in the rain, and then I lost consciousness. I don't have any recall of what happened, of my dad coming there. I vaguely have a vision of him coming, driving up, but I don't have any recall of him putting me in the car until several hours later when I woke up in bed at home. And so I lost several hours of consciousness, and then I was truly sick with very much similar symptoms to what I had later with Lyme disease. So I had terrific night sweats, terrible, awful headaches, spinal pain, fever. I was just really, really sick. And we lived rural, and I don't even recall whether my parents even took me to a doctor. But I do recall one thing: nobody ever suggests that it was the shot. The conditioning starts there. Nobody tells you that it could possibly be the shot.
Well, but Leon, when you say it was the shot, what do you mean? What role did the shot play in your view in your illness? And was it if you were going to accept our definition of risk as being threat time vulnerability, are you arguing the shot made you more vulnerable to the illness?
I'm arguing that the shot may have started the illness, triggered the illness. At the very least, it was a trigger.
Oh,
But I.
trigger meaning what? Meaning, do you believe that the microbes that ultimately caused you to suffer from Lyme disease were shot into you by the shot? Or do you believe that the shot made you more vulnerable and immunocompromised, and therefore the microbes that were in you, for example, from the tick bite that you had in your head, ultimately took off and you got sick that way?
Well, in later years, when you really start to find out, because nobody in those days even wrote down what you got. So, but now we know what is in some of those shots. So the excipients in the shot, we're talking about heavy metals. We're talking about, what they know about weaponized pathogens now. They know that Judy Mikovits has testified that there's Borrelia in the shots. So there are pathogens in the shots. There are excipients in the shots. There are all kinds of heavy metals, all kinds of other chemicals, and mercury is huge, especially in the flu shot. And so I have doctors that tell my friends, well, you're just allergic to mercury. Well, who's not allergic to mercury? I mean, that's a poison. It's a heavy metal. And so was it the shot, or was it a combination of the shot with the Borrelia? Well, probably both. But at that point in my life, we didn't suspect anything, just that
So,
it was another illness.
share with us how your health declined over time up until the time you were diagnosed with Lyme disease.
Yeah, my life changed after that. So I'd been a really active kid, and then all of a sudden, it was totally different. I could not, I got sick easily. So I pick up everything that came along. I would pick up everything. And if somebody was sick or if something was going around, even at school, I would get it and I'd get it five times worse than everybody else. And up until that point, I'd never really gotten sick that easily. I couldn't be as active because I had muscle pain and joint pain all the time. Like you go to school and you do PE class, and PE class for girls at that time was awful. You do an hour of calisthenics, and then I would go home, and the next day I could barely walk. And my dad would go, "What are you? It's so terrible. How did they exercise you that hard?" And I would go back to school, and some of my friends, they'd be okay, but I would just suffer from severe muscle pain, joint pain. I had a trampoline. I could no longer jump on the trampoline because my neck hurt so bad all the time. And so, and then over life, you know, we kind of just accepted it, but people start thinking, well, cause you go to the doctor. I was hospitalized numerous times. I'd get sick and then I would be put in the hospital and then they'd say, "Oh, there's nothing. There's nothing. Your blood tests all look fine. You're fine. It's nothing." And so pretty soon people start to think that like, you are faking it, or you're just wanting attention because they can't find anything in their blood test at all. And so that was how life changed for me. And I just got used to living that way. You just get used to, okay, life is just like this for me. And so I just have to go with it. And then when I got married, I got sick the night before I got married. Anytime there was high stress, I would get sick. And so like I got sick during college exams, I'd get sick. I got sick before we got married. And that's the joke with my husband. My husband always said, "Well, I don't never wanted to marry a sick girl." Only on our honeymoon, we couldn't go skiing because I got sick. And so then I came home and I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, you kind of have a measles, like you have this rash. It's like measles. You look like measles." And I said, "Well, how would I get measles?" But you know, I got over it after a while, and I just kind of muddled through for about, well, at least through my first four children, I muddled through and I did okay.
So Leah, let me ask a question. One of the things that we hear almost uniformly from the young women that we interview is that the first concern they have is whether or not they can have children. When you were going through your life as a young person, managing all these illnesses, did you have concerns about whether or not you could have children and or have healthy children?
No, that was never, I didn't have issues that way. I did have issues with my periods, my reproductive, you know, your monthly periods. That finally later down the road when I got a hysterectomy, and that was because of Lyme too, the doctor said, "Well, you didn't tell me you had endometriosis." And he said, "You didn't tell me you had painful periods," because they, you know, they do a biopsy of your of what they take out. And I said, "Well, I just thought that was normal. I just thought everybody suffered like that. Everybody was that was a normal thing." And so yeah, but as far as having children, no, I didn't have any troubles. But until my fifth and sixth child. So that's when things started to really change for me. And actually, I have to tell this part of my story. So in 1986, I had my fourth child, and I had a dream. And the dream was very symbolic, but when I woke up, it was so powerful that I knew that God was trying to tell me something. And I won't share all of the dream, but basically, he was trying to tell me that life was going to change, that I would be tested. But the power to heal would be given back to me at some time. The journey would end at some time. And he would kind of give me signposts along the way. He helped me along the way, but the life was going to be very, very different. And it wasn't until 30 years later that I actually kind of started to put together the dream. And that had a lot to do with Chris Newby's book and all kinds of other things. But I realized that dream came out of Isaiah 54. And Isaiah is a very difficult book to understand. It's very symbolic. And I realized that when I read Isaiah 54, that was my dream. And at the end of Isaiah 54, it says, no weapon formed against you will prosper. And every tongue that shall revile against you, thou shalt condemn. That's the heritage of the servants of the Lord. And so I didn't really understand it. It was kind of like Joseph's dream. I didn't really understand what he was trying to tell me, but I knew it was really significant, and I didn't understand what the weapon was. But at that point in my life, that's when things started to change in my life.
Okay, now when you say change for the positive, because you now had an understanding of your journey, or change for the negative because you didn't properly interpret the dream and understand the journey? I mean, tell, what do you mean change?
No, that's when things started to get hard. That's when things really began to change. So the first thing that happened was my mom got diagnosed with cancer. My mom got cancer because she took hormone therapy that was made with horse urine. That was the original hormone therapy. And years later, they found out that caused many reproductive cancers in women. And my mom got ovarian cancer, and she lived for 2 years and went through very difficult things. And then a couple of years later, my dad actually went through a Lyme-like illness. He had a septic joint, and it was so painful and so awful, and they blew it out, but just like with Lyme, they couldn't see any microbes or anything, but he eventually died from that. And that was a big trauma for me, because actually when my mom died, I was pregnant with my fifth child, and she died the week after he was born. And so it was a huge trauma. And as all of us who have Lyme disease know, traumas can also be big triggers for this. So for me, it was kind of relaxing and remitting most of my life. Like, you know, I'd get a flare, then I'd get better, and then I'd have another flare. And so after that, my health started to plummet. So I hadn't had Colin, I hadn't had my fourth, third son, and I hadn't had Claire yet. And I was pregnant with my third son when my mom died. I mean, your fifth son. I'm, no, my fifth child.
Yeah.
My
okay. Third yeah, son. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You got him.
and he was born, and then my husband had a dream. So my husband had a dream, and he dreamed that there was still one more child. And so I was like, really? I mean, I don't feel good. And do we really have to do this again? Is this really right? Is this really what God wants? But he had a dream and saw this beautiful young woman with dark hair that was like, Dad, don't let mom not, I gotta come down. So I, you know, because my husband and I, you know, we have worked together so well over the 44 years, and I trusted him. So I thought, okay, you know, I'd lost my mom. I wasn't feeling very good, but we'll do this one more time. And in my husband's dream, he had this dream that this child would someday be with us and would help us and help us through this great trial that we would have to go through. And he saw what she looked like, and that she had darker hair, and that was unusual because all my kids were blonde except her. So he saw exactly what she looked like. And so I said, okay, all right, well, let's try one more. And so after my dad died, we had one more. And Claire was not a healthy child. So, you know, to your point about, can this be transmitted? Yeah, I think it can, because, but was that everything, or was she triggered by, you know, those immunizations? And so.
Let's walk that back. So first of all, thank God you had child number six, because we wouldn't have.
Yeah, that's right.
We wouldn't have your co-interviewee and my often co-host Claire with us, right?
So. We joke in our family that if it wasn't for Dad and his dream, Mom would have given me up for adoption. So we're really glad that Mom and Dad hung on to me for this long.
Yes, thank God. So, you know, we It's always hard to determine what caused what when we're talking about illnesses that often have a temporal gap between exposure and illness, right? But you did say that when Claire was born, she wasn't a healthy child. Now, did you mean in her infancy, or did you, or are you saying that as time went on, Claire's health, indicated, she just wasn't a healthy little person as opposed to an infant?
No, it was more that she was similar to me in that if there was an illness going around, she would pick it up easily. And we'd go to church and they'd have a nursery at church, and Claire every Sunday would get sick, and she would just get sick so easily. So
Well, and we were talking about this the other day too, that I was like raised on that pink stuff that is antibiotics for kids. I
yeah.
just remember that being a normal part of my life, always taking that pink stuff
Me
every
too.
morning. Yeah.
Bubblegum medicine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, antibiotics they gave out freely.
Because
I
I
mean,
constantly had strep throat and ear infections, so they just were constantly giving me the antibiotics, and
well, I think
which
it's
is a
because
normal part.
you have that brown-haired kid, so you weren't going to have the same robust immune system as all the blonde people have.
Obviously, obviously.
So,
So,
but I'm trying, Leanne, I'm trying to get a handle here. Do you believe that that Claire was born with congenital Lyme disease?
I do now, but we had no idea then why it was different, except that during my pregnancy, I was older, so I was 37 by that time, and I had six kids, and she was my sixth kid. So I just thought, well, this is just, I'm getting older and I've had six kids, but I had my health issues, but we've managed okay. And so we just thought that, for whatever reason, she was picking things up a lot worse than everybody else was. And so we didn't really think about it that much. It's another thing you put on your shelf and you just go on with life. And but then we had another turn in the road. So then we moved to a different house, and we moved near these foothills of Utah. And there were up in the foothills behind our house, there were these big, huge power lines. And they were actually building a bike park underneath these power lines. So there were kids on this, in this bike park, riding their bikes and jumping on jumps and doing all those kind of things all the time. And we were foolish. We were really actually stupid, I think, because everybody said, oh, it's no big deal, it's okay, there's nothing wrong with that. And but that's when things changed. And I just have to tell you that this area that we lived in Utah is not that far from Dugway, where Chris Newby talks about the things that were dropped on Dugway and the killing of the sheep. She talked about all of that in her book and so forth. And this is an area that is very close to that area. Our health just really began to plummet. My health and Claire's began to plummet.
Well, and there was a lot of things at play for this too, because not only were we living in front of really high intensity power lines, but we were also living in a neighborhood that was not the healthiest neighborhood for us. And we were undergoing a lot of persecution, might I say, from the people in our church. My dad was serving as a bishop at the time. And so we were undergoing a lot of emotional stress, like very intense emotional stress. And that coupled with the high intensity power lines, mom went down really hard. And that was, I think, our first really big scare of realizing mom's not going to get better this time.
Okay, so
Yeah.
Claire, let's talk about that again. I want to bring you back to the risk formula, because if risk is defined as threat times vulnerability, you move to a place where you are going to be more vulnerable to illness because of the EMFs that you were living with. You are more vulnerable to becoming ill because you were living in a very stressful environment, and it sounds like you had a greater threat of getting sick, because as Leanne was just suggesting, you are now living in an area where there were weaponized ticks that have been, that have since, been identified as having a more viral form of the bacteria that had traditionally been in the tick. So You know, as you know, Leanne, as you're beginning to define this for me, I'm just wincing because I see the train coming down the tracks and Leanne getting run over
The perfect
because
storm.
both elements of the risk formula were there, where you were substantially more vulnerable to the illness because you were going to be immunocompromised and you had a substantially greater threat of coming in contact with a microbe that was designed to make you sick.
Yeah, and to your point about the area, so Utah began to be defined as one of the capitals of MS at that time. And there were several women in our neighborhood that either had been diagnosed with MS or they were not doing well living along that corridor there. And so at age 49, I got really sick. I got so sick that they put me in the hospital, and I was there about a week, and every day I got worse, and it's the same thing: the night sweats, the fevers, the intense pain, but also this weird way that people in the hospitals treat you. So I just have to tell you, in Utah, they tell you that there is no such thing as Lyme disease, and they're in the hospitals they don't treat you very nice. I mean, I haven't been in one for at least 5 or 6 years, seven or 8 years, I'm sure.
In a minute.
Yeah, but during those times, even in that area, I lived in a city called Lehigh, and you'd go into the hospitals and they would laugh and joke and say, "Oh, we call that Lehigh disease because you guys think you're sick, but it's not really a sickness." And so you're in the hospital and you're so sick you can't really function, and they're treating you like you have some mental disorder, and even though you have obvious symptoms of you're really declining. In fact, the doctor would come in every day and say, "You're getting worse. I don't know what's wrong." And then I developed hospital pneumonia. And so at that point, my husband went home to Claire and my son and got them ready because he didn't think I was going to make it through that. He thought I was going to go. And that was really hard. So,
and at that point in time too, there was Lyme disease was not on the table. We didn't know Lyme disease was a thing. We didn't know it could have had that. I believe you were also diagnosed with mono. Is that right, Mom?
Yeah, well, that's the only thing they could figure out. Like Epstein-Barr and the mono spot test.
Yeah, so there was no like idea that this could possibly be Lyme disease. We were going in this completely blind to everything that we learned along the way. And so we just had no idea what was happening at the time.
So what year was this, Leanne? Was it after Burgdorfer released his alleged discovery of the Lyme bacteria, or was this before that?
It was about let's see, I was 48, so we had.
Oh, you were 48. It's after.
It was after Burgdorfer, you know, but it was before Chris Newby had released her book. She hadn't released her book yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we keep referencing Chris Newby's book. Let's talk a little bit about that. So the title of the book is Bitten. And it's a, you know, certainly a book that has been well received in the Lyme disease community. And we here at Sick Bootcamp conducted a lengthy interview with Chris Newby on this issue. So if folks are interested in learning more about the book Bitten and want to hear a very thorough cross-examination of the author by yours truly, I strongly invite you or urge you to listen to that podcast. It was one of our most listened to podcasts. So, Leanne, let's frame another piece of your journey, and I'd like you to talk to us about that moment when you're in the hospital where you're getting sicker and sicker, right? And I'd like you to share with us how much you think the gaslighting that you were suffering from in the hospital made you more vulnerable and made you sicker just by virtue of the way you were being treated by the medical professionals who were charged with your care at that time.
Oh, that's a huge piece. That's just a big piece, because when you're that sick and you know that you are sick, and even when you have symptoms and they're treating you like you're not even having symptoms, because they've been trained to say, well, there is no such thing as this. I remember going to the doctor shortly after that to an emergency room on another, because when I got really, really bad, and the doctors came in and just said, well, there is nothing with all your symptoms, and I don't have any idea what to do with you. So, and I just got angry. I said, well, then rip this thing out of my arm and we're out the door, because if that's all you've got to give me. And he kind of backed off and left. And then the nurse came in and apologized for him and said, he's still a good guy and all these things. But when you are that sick, and the problem with this too, Rich, is that then your family, your people around you start to believe what the doctors are telling you too. And and that's the worst part, because when you're that sick and nobody believes you, then if you don't have a good support system, I mean, they know this with cancer, but with Lyme, they just think it's not the same thing, but it is the same thing. And when they treat you like that, it's you start to question yourself, or is there really, am I just off base? Am I crazy here? Is it wrong? But I had severe symptoms. So the bleeding got worse when I was living in that house. So I had a hysterectomy. And I wish I'd never done that, but I didn't know what else to do. And because my mother had ovarian cancer, they pushed the narrative that, well, your mother had ovarian cancer, so you're probably having this issue too. So I got a hysterectomy, and within 1 month, my gallbladder got really, really, really bad. And so then they did another test on me, and they did a HIDA scan to see what's happening with your gallbladder. And my gallbladder was like functioning at 9%. And so they said, well, we got to take it out. So I took it out. And I wish I hadn't done that too. But years, when I finally went to my Lyme literate medical doctor, he did a test on me, and a heavy metal test, and they showed that gadolinium was off the charts for me. And gadolinium is what, oh, that one actor, now I can't think of his name, who did the karate and all that. He's suing for his, Chuck Norris, he's suing for his wife, because his wife had the same issue. She had high doses of gadolinium, and they know that goes to your brain. It causes a lot of problems with your nervous system. It gives you intense, awful headaches. And so after I had the gallbladder surgery, things just got worse. But the worst part was the electricity. So this is one thing I want to say to all people who suffer from Lyme. So what happened with me was, in that house, it got so bad, and we got so sensitive to electricity, I couldn't even be in a room with a cell phone or a computer at all. And it got so bad that my husband went out and he bought a gas meter. So he wanted to start testing. And I had started sleeping downstairs because I was more comfortable downstairs. So he measured out in the backyard, he measured all around the house. And the lowest place in the house was where I had picked to sleep, because I instinctively knew that I was a little bit safer there. But I got so sensitive to electricity. So now at this time, Claire's going to a private school,
When
and
I was in high school.
she's was chosen to be the lead in the play. And I had gotten so sick, and the worst part was interstitial cystitis, which Dr. Rawls talks about, and it was terrible. It was awful. It was the worst pain I'd ever had, urinary tract pain. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you probably have no tests, no tissue tests, no anything. Well, I think you have interstitial cystitis, and it's a genetic thing, and there's nothing you can do about it. You'll just have to live with it the rest of your life. And after 15 minutes, he said goodbye, and I bawled in the waiting room, then left. And I thought, there has to be more to it than just this. That's all it is. But I went to Claire's play, and they were using cordless mics. And they didn't have the greatest sound system, and the mics were cracking and everything. And I sat in that play, and it felt like bolts of lightning were going down through my head, down through my feet, every time the mic cracked. And so by the time the play was over, I felt like I'd been struck by lightning. It was the worst feeling ever. And I really felt like I was gonna die. And my husband took me home, and we got home, and I had a seizure. That was the first of many seizures. And so my husband finally decided, we can't stay here. That this place is killing me, my wife. And my husband was bishop of our ward, and he prayed, and God just told him, Bob, you can either, you know, step down from being bishop and go take care of your wife, or if not, she's going to die. And he, thank goodness, decided to step down and take me out of there. And we actually left our house in the middle of the night because it got so bad. So I went to live with some of my kids for a short while. And then things got just so much worse. And then I spent a lot of time went to a naturopath, and he gave me apple pectin to drink, but that was the only thing he could do for me. I got into an MS doctor. I finally got into an MS doctor. Oh, but before this, they diagnosed me with hepatitis C. So they did a blood test and they said, you have hepatitis C. And then it was over Christmas. And so, like Chris Newby talked about, it just takes forever to get into these doctors. So you think you're dying and nobody can take you. And so, and nobody, once they told me that, nobody wanted to be around me. So I think I have hepatitis C, and I go in, and the gastro guy says, no, you don't have hepatitis C, but you have something autoimmune. So I went back to my regular doctor, and the nurse, the regular doctor, tells me, you know, you were on this list where there were all these people that that were diagnosed with hepatitis C from their blood tests. And the hospital came out and said, these were all false. They were all false. And you were on that list. Did the doctor ever tell you? And I said, no, the doctor never told me anything. But that would have been nice to know, because I just spent a whole lot of money on a gastro doctor who told me I don't have that. And so that was the first thing. Then they finally sent me to an MS doctor. And he was actually the best of all. Actually, that was after the neurologist who told me that the only thing he could give me was antidepressants, that maybe I just needed some antidepressants. And that was it, because none of my neurology tests proved anything. But I finally went to the MS doctor, and the MS doctor said, you could have MS, but you're too old. He told me I was too old, for one thing. And he said, your white matter in your brain isn't typically MS. And he ran me through a whole bunch of physical type exercises to see how my reflexes and so forth were. He said, your reflexes are off the charts. Like, you respond so quickly to everything, which is why eventually I quit driving, because my reflexes were so bad. But then he sent me home, and a month later, he said, I don't think you have MS, but go to this doctor. And it was a Lyme doctor.
Why did you go to an MS doctor, and who is it that recommended that you be evaluated for MS?
That was my general practitioner who said, let's try, after the neurologist, he said, let's try to send you to an MS doctor and see what he says. So that's why. And out of all the doctors, he was in Salt Lake, and he was, out of all the doctors, he was the most helpful. But he didn't really tell me that this was a Lyme doctor. And when I got to this doctor had actually started out being a hormone doctor. And 75% of his patients walking in the door were Lyme patients, and he was figuring this out. But he was a young doctor, and later he told Claire, when she was diagnosed, because he diagnosed her too. So he told Claire that he'd had a sister that was sick all the time, and they'd made fun of her, and they thought she was, you know, just making things up. And then when he became a doctor himself, he got through his residency and everything, he realized what Lyme disease really was, and he realized that's what she had. And he went to her and apologized to her and said, I'm so sorry that I didn't know this. But when I got there, I was in so much pain. And he said, you kind of scare me, because I don't want to do stuff that will make you worse. And he turned around and took the book off the shelf that was Horowitz's book, that Why Can't I Get All Better? Because that was that was the only big line book at that time. At that time, and he said, "Read this book, and you can help me treat you." And so that was a little discouraging because I thought, "Oh, I have to help you read this book, and how much do you really know?" But you know, to his defense, he was trying to help people, but he had a lot of pushback from the powers that be. That they didn't want him.
Let's talk about that, right? Because I think one of the reasons why doctors fail us is because they're not humble, right? And
yeah.
and I think one of the patterns that I've seen develop here with your testimony is that you were gaslit repeatedly by medical professionals who did not have training that allowed them to have a framework to permit them to see what was actually wrong with you. And if
yeah.
a doctor doesn't know what's wrong with you, it must be there's nothing wrong with you, right? And that's one of the problems with doctors having to know everything rather than being humble. And as it turns out, the doctor who had you the most concern, because he was in fact humble and was inviting you to be a partner, is not
right.
The person you initially reacted to positively.
Yeah, that's true. So, well, and I, to my defense, I thought I was dying. I mean, I hurt so
No,
bad. I
no,
couldn't
but
even.
Leanne, I don't think you need to defend yourself. I think it's the way we've been set up by the industrial medical complex,
Yeah.
where they tell us they know all the answers to our problems, that we do not need to be partners in our own care, and they're going to give us a pharmaceutical of some sort after a quick diagnosis, and we're going to get better, right? So
Yeah.
it's not so much we have to defend ourselves for being sick or not having the proper mindset. It's that we've been conditioned by a culture of business professionals to believe that we're not supposed to participate in our own care. And when somebody invites us to partner with them, we're repelled by that because it's not the way we've been conditioned.
Yeah.
Well, and to your point, Rich, we have come to this place in society where we're encouraged to outsource everything. We outsource the food we eat to the fast food restroom, the fast food restaurants. We outsource our entertainment to movie theaters and to going out and to doing something. So we're not home with the family anymore. We've outsourced love and compassion to the churches and the church leaders. And instead of just watching out for each other as neighbors, and we've now outsourced our health to the medical system. So everything has been outsourced. And so, like you said, we're trained from a very young age that a doctor should be able to hand me something and it will take away my pain and I should not have to do anything. And not only has that created a lot of problems, but it's created great complacency in people's ability to realize that we have to take personal responsibility for our health in order to get well. And if we can't take that personal responsibility when you're fighting a beast this big, we probably won't get well, because it takes many, many tools in your toolbox. And as you can see from Mom's story, many, many doctors, many, many things that we have to address. And so we have to take that personal responsibility. And when you're in that much pain, you're greatly also relying on the personal responsibility of your caregivers and your family and the people that are caring for you, because you can barely function yourself. And so we've just kind of, it's like we've said before, we've created the perfect storm where we have, you know, these outer things hitting us, but then we have the inward things hitting us, and everything is hitting us. And what do when the perfect storm has just launched a missile at us and we don't know what to do? Yeah.
So Kyle, let me ask you a question about sentience and that which makes us unique as humans, right? What makes us unique is that we're aware of our thoughts, we're aware of our feelings, and we're aware of our actions, or at least we have the capacity to be aware of our thoughts, our feelings, and our actions. And what happens when we're gaslit the way your mother was gaslit, what we start to do is we start to doubt our own sentience, right? We start to doubt the onboard diagnostic system that God has given to us. And I think generally, I think the medical industrial complex has done that to us. And then the doctors who we should be partnering with, further remove from us our sentience. So give me your thoughts, Claire, on how that makes us more vulnerable and more likely to become chronically ill. And then, Leanne, I'd love your reaction to that as well.
Yeah, so the emotions play a massive role in our ability to get better. And what I have found in my journey watching mom, but then also going through it myself, is that if you don't have a really strong support system, your battle is almost twice as hard because love, care, help, service, all of those things are an actual frequency. They're an actual energy that helps to heal the cells in our body. It helps to heal our hearts, our minds. And so not only are we having nothing, okay, where people just kind of ignore you, but then you're having also the opposite end where people are coming against you and telling you that you're crazy, that it's all in your head, they don't believe you. And we have to understand too that these are really hellish, hellish situations. So we talk about our interactions with our doctors, but what we don't talk about enough is just what's happening within the four walls of our house. So we're talking like when I was a teenager, I woke up to mom screaming every single night of my life. And I didn't know what to do about that. But I'll never forget the night that my dad took my mom out to the living room and he flipped the light switch to turn the fireplace on. And that electrical spark hit my mom so hard that it sent her to the ground and she screamed blood-curdling screams. And I woke up to blood-curdling screams, ran out to the living room to find my mom having a seizure and just screaming in this intense amount of pain. And that experience alone changed me forever as a
I'm
kid
sorry.
because I never ever thought that would be something that I'd have to face. And it's not something you ever think about when you're a teenager, but these are really hellish experiences where we're talking about screams and tears and just wondering, are you going to live tomorrow? Am I going to come home from school and my dad's going to tell me that my mom's not here anymore? And I look back and I think, how did I even get through any of that? These are very hellish situations. So then to have people, whether that's doctors or people in your religious community or your neighbors or your friends or your family. And if you're like us, we were hit by all of those people telling us that they didn't believe us or they just abandoned us completely, which
Well,
basically means that they don't believe us. And that made it a very difficult situation for us to get well because for a while it was just me and mom and dad fighting the good fight and we were all sick. And there were some nights I was like, God, are we just gonna die in this house and like nobody will even find our bodies for like years because no one cares? It really messes with your mind. And I really believe because I've experienced the opposite that if there were people to just love us and to help us and to see that they care, that would have made our healing journey a lot better. And that goes for all of them, doctors, medical people, religious people, friends, neighbors. We really need to make space for these people because that will help us in our healing journey.
But Claire, isn't it really just the doctors who they're separating us from ourselves when they gaslight us, right? We're separated from our sentience or our understanding or of our thoughts, feelings, and actions, but also separating us from each other because they start to create doubt in the minds of the people who should be loving you up, but they don't know how to love you up because they certainly don't want to, they certainly don't want to enable someone who needs a different type of assistance not to get that assistance. And then we end up being separated from people in our own family and the people in our church communities who don't know how to help us because the doctors are saying that it's not what it is.
That's a big issue, but it's also the other problem too, where they almost don't want to interfere with the doctors. They think that is the role of the medical system. And if you haven't had a lot of experience in the medical system, you don't know that they don't care about you at all. You think, you're getting some care in those hospitals, but you're not. And so they think that that's the role of the medical system. And I've even heard this amongst church members in my own church where they're like, what do you want us to do that the doctors aren't already doing for you? The doctors just aren't doing it. That's just the honest answer.
So, Leanne, one of the things that I was thinking when Claire was sharing her perspective on frequency is that, I'm hearing, we're hearing a lot about your traditional faith. We hear about you talking about God, but then we have this frequency thing coming in, which sounds kind of woo-woo, and it's not what I expect to hear from Christians. So, talk to me a little bit about how, I don't know, woo-woo kind of understanding has come to be a part of your healing despite your traditional Christian values.
Well, we changed. Claire was just talking about this last night about how Just starting essential oils was weird to my husband and to Claire. And then what we end up doing now is really woo-woo. But if you think about it, you know, what is prayer? Well, prayer is talking to God, and it's energy, it's frequency, there is a light, a frequency that allows us to talk to God. And it's a real thing. Love is a frequency. So, you know, the map of the scale of consciousness, which is written by
the book Power Versus Force.
Yeah, no,
I can't remember who wrote it. Yeah. Power Versus Force is the book.
But, you know, he talks about how different emotions have different frequencies. And the closer you get to God, the closer, you know, the higher your frequency is going to be. And so what I learned is that people who showed me love could actually take away pain. So my biggest symptom was pain. I mean, I just had extreme pain all the time. And for about 5 or 6 years, all I could think about was pain. If I watched a TV show, all I could think about was pain. If I went somewhere with my husband, like he'd take me on walks all the time, take me out in the country. So I'd get out and be walking in the sun. And my memories are all about how bad did I feel that day? What did it feel like that day? And so I learned that if somebody came to visit me, and that didn't happen very often, my pain would go away. And how does that happen? Well, that happens because love is a frequency. And if somebody actually shows you genuine love, you can feel that in your body. You can feel how that changes you. And I could feel that from my husband. My husband has never left me. He suffered too. We haven't talked about that, but he was suffering too. And he had things that he had to overcome. It wasn't on the level that we were, but he was suffering from Lyme disease symptoms as well and was diagnosed. And so
to connect that to the Christian end of things, I mean, we all know as Christians that Jesus performed miracles. He healed people. So was Jesus handing out medications and telling us to take psychosomatic drugs? No, that's not what Jesus was doing. He healed people. And the reason why he had power to heal people is because he loves us. He loves every single one of us. And that's why he can heal people. And so all we're doing is learning how to access the same laws of healing through God, through his power, through the power he used to heal people. And so that's why we have that view of energy now. And it's all connected to God. It's his power. It's his authority. And that's really changed our healing journey to be able to learn that. Because honestly, how did we pull through, the three of us, me, my dad, and my mom? We loved each other. There are moments in Lyme disease that you don't know what to do. We've tried every single protocol we could. We've tried, you know, and the pain just doesn't stop. So what do? Well, we love each other and we pray really hard until the pain stops. Sometimes that is the only thing that worked for us. And it's a miracle, but it's the healing power of God is what we really believe.
All right. So let's get to the diagnosis, Lynn, because we've heard about all of the pain and all the suffering and all the challenges that you had. But of course, I'm now looking at two very healthy women. So first, talk to us about how you were diagnosed, how the rest of your family was diagnosed, and then what steps did you take on your healing journey to get from where you were to where you are?
Okay. So the Lyme doctor that I talked to you about, that was new but humble, he basically, well, first the first thing he did was he took 26 vials of blood from all of us. First me, and I felt like a vampire had just drained me, but he tested for everything. He tested for, you know, all kinds of co-infections, all kinds of things, and it came back. And these were things that I had no idea what these things were. So cytomegalovirus, HHV, mycoplasma, Babesia, you know, all of these things that I had no idea what any of these things were, Epstein-Barr, you know, and he took a normal CD57, and my CD57 was like under 60 or something like that. And so he automatically said, with the first visit, he said, I give you 75% chance that you have Lyme disease. And that's without doing the blood test. But then we began the blood test. So And then the worst one, and the most, the biggest piece that's kind of important for later down the road is the mycoplasma. So the mycoplasma should have been under 300, and my mycoplasma was 900. And Claire's was about that, and my husband's was close to it. And so, but my husband had totally different, he had totally different symptoms. He had pain in his feet, and his feet would swell and get these pockets in them that were horrendously painful. So in his 50s, my husband was on crutches a lot because of this. And they could never tell you what it was. They said, oh, it's gout. And then the gout test would come back. No, it's not gout. It's not this. They gave him these expensive, heavy-duty antibiotics that wouldn't do anything for very long. And if he exerted himself in any way, then these pockets in his feet would come back, and they'd be terrible. So we all, at that point, we all got, well, Claire didn't get tested yet. My husband and I got tested. So we did the Western blot. And the Western blot came back equivocal. So, of course, then they say, well, you could have it, but you might not have it. And it was only the Lyme doctor that said, well, yeah, I think you have it. So it's a clinical diagnosis. But he was getting a lot of heat for giving a clinical diagnosis. You can't do that in Utah. So we started to do some things, like we did the blood ozone and we did some things like that, and it would help you for a time, but it wasn't really helping me. By that time, I had spinal knots, my jaws were swollen, I couldn't get my teeth to go together, I had ringing and ticking in my ears all the time, I had severe joint pain, headaches. Sometimes I couldn't even lay in a bed without hurting all the time. I would wake up in the morning and I was like, please God, please just take me home. I can't do this anymore. Please just take me home. So then Claire was at the point where she was starting college, and you know, I know you've heard her story, but just briefly, she was starting college and she was a vocal major, and she got a scholarship to Southern Utah University, and so we sent her off, but things were changing with Claire, and things were not right. When we were in that house near the power lines, by this time we'd gone to a different house, but in that house near the power lines, Claire was having 2 periods a month, so she was bleeding excessively, things weren't right, and I started a protocol. Well, I will. It was the BX protocol, and you can't find it anymore. But it was a PhD who had developed an energy catalyst that would help to clear out your mitochondria. And he did. He was a member of our church, but he was also a very inspired guy. He felt like God had directed him to do this in his lab, and he had a clinic in Salt Lake City. But the powers that be, right before I started with him, shut him down. And so he wasn't able, he was actually helping fourth stage cancer patients who were in hospice. He was helping them come out of hospice and regain their health. And he started working with some live patients. And so he was only able to do it online. And he was helping us. And I actually did have a major improvement during those years. But Claire was plummeting.
So. Yeah, so mom started the BX protocol before I was even diagnosed, or I had gone to get my blood tests or anything. And we went for my first batch of blood tests right before I left for college. And then I left for college. We left it at that until we got the results while I was in college.
And but, yeah, so at fall break,
yeah,
she got her results.
I got my results during fall break, but at that point, my health had plummeted so hard. I was like, I kind of hate college because I'm always in pain and I'm always feeling panic and I'm always, and it was just a really big stressor. And so then we got my results back.
It also wasn't in alignment with your father's dream, because you were supposed to be the one there to help heal your parents on this journey, and you had separated from them.
I know, you know, I haven't even thought about that until recently, but yeah, it's true. And so I remember at one point just praying to God and asking him, do I have to stay here? Like, I get that I'm a young single adult and I have to go to college and have a job and all these things, but do I really have to stay here? And my answer was no, Claire, you've done what I need you to do here. go home. I was like, thank you, Lord. Like, I hate it here.
And actually, the PhD that was helping us said, if I were you, I'd go get her and take her out.
Yeah.
Because she's, you don't want her to get worse. So we got her, brought her home. I actually was still driving at that point.
Mom drove me home with like a level 20 headache, and I just conked out in the car because I was so sick.
Yeah, nobody would help us because they didn't believe we were sick. So we just muddled through. So we actually went to go. It was like 4 or 5 hours away to go get her. So we went and got her. And I drove home, and Claire got in the car, and she just collapsed. And she just slept the whole way home. And I'm thinking, God, what am I doing? I feel like I'm dying myself. What are we doing? Why is this happening to us? You know, why is it like this? But I knew that she was supposed to come home. She came home, and then she spent the next 2 to 3 years really sick with us.
So what was the treatment, Claire, that you started using after you came home from school?
Yeah, so actually I started the same treatment Mom was on. Mom had already been on it for about a year, so it was the BX protocol. And I actually started it in college. And so that added to my stress levels because I had to sleep with oxygen tubes at night to oxygenate my cells. That was part of the treatment. So I was sleeping in oxygen tubes, which, by the way, if you're a college student and your roommates know that you sleep with oxygen tubes, they think you're very strange. So I was doing that. And then I had to rate my symptoms from like 1 to 10 every single day. And that was a very long list of symptoms. So my doctor had to see that. And I had to take all my vitals every single day. And I was thinking, how am I going to maintain my scholarship and also maintain my health? And that's what I was faced with. So when I came home, I just basically continued on that treatment. And so Mom did the BX protocol for about 2 years, and I did the BX protocol for about 1 year. And I will tell you that the one thing that was really amazing about that protocol is that particular doctor taught us the importance of diet, and that changed our entire life. At that point, both me and Mom had health problems, and we went on the worst diets ever. We ate like a lot of tofu, and we basically went meat free, dairy free, like everything free. And I was raised on sugar. So that was like a trauma for me. Like, I can't eat anything all of a sudden. Like, what? But that doctor taught us how to do diet and how to do it correctly. And he taught us the importance of eating organic. And yeah, I did have to give up everything except like lettuce at one point. But as we slowly were able to introduce things back, that was one of the things that we got our ability to eat back, which was incredible. And so that protocol really helped us to help to train us the beginnings of our diet journey.
It also taught us, in order to be on the BX, you had to get off of all your meds. So we got off all our meds.
Yeah, that was the other thing.
That's the number one thing for us.
Which was huge for us. I was raised on antibiotics. I was raised on medication. Mom, our first pill dump was all those orange bottles. And it was tons of orange bottles of pain meds and antibiotics. And
thyroid medication.
Yep, thyroid medication. We just got off all of it. We were done. It was making Mom especially a lot worse because she was on a lot of it. And so we just dumped it and we were done.
And I made a conscious decision. I wasn't going back. I wasn't going to take anything over the counter anymore. I wasn't going to take any of that. It was like God said, no more. Don't take that anymore. So we got off that. But the one thing the BX didn't do is it wasn't teaching us anything about detox.
So yeah. Our Herximers were like through the roof awful. Like, I got sicker when I came home from college because the Herximers were so intense that I could barely stand up, like just to walk to the bathroom or to the refrigerator. Like, it was awful.
Yeah. So Clara, because we have a diverse group of people that listen to this podcast, some people who are new to the Lyme community and some people who are more familiar with Lyme community, I always like to walk it back and go through some definitions for folks. So let's first talk about herxing. What is herxing, and what were the herxes like when each of you were dealing with your Herxheimer reactions?
Yeah, so herxing is as you are killing the Lyme bacteria in your system, that's a painful process. So similar to when you're doing chemotherapy, and people who have cancer and they're doing chemo, they experience intense pain while they're doing the treatment therapy. So very similar with Lyme, as you're killing the Lyme bacteria and detoxing it out of your system, it can be very, very painful. And so if you kill the Lyme too quickly and you're not doing anything to detox and to get your channels up and going, which we didn't understand that at all, you can have very intense Herxheimer reactions.
All right. So one of the things you were talking about before is that you were toxic, right? I mean, and that's why your immune system was not functioning. And then what's happening now is as you have this die-off from killing the microbes, you're becoming more toxic. And because you're becoming more toxic, your immune system doesn't only know to attack living organisms, it will also attack the remnants of a former living organism. And so between the toxicity and your immune system, which of course we know is compromised from the microbes that it's fighting, you're just getting sicker and sicker, right? So how did you all deal with that? And was that a part of the protocol that you were using, the detox element of your protocol?
No, that's the one thing that they weren't really great at teaching us about detox. And so that's why Claire said we were hurting all the time without really understanding that you have to get your filters open. You've got to know what detox really is. And we really didn't understand
that. For the people who, you know, aren't unfamiliar with what it means when your channels are open, that means you have to be going to the bathroom every single day, twice a day. It means you have to be sweating on a regular basis. Sweat is a huge way to detox out of our skin. Making sure we're eating healthy, drinking green juice. These things are all things that can help to curb Herxheimer's, but we had no idea. When I was in high school and I took PE class, I couldn't sweat. I never would sweat. I could run a mile and I wouldn't sweat. And all the girls in my class would be like, that's so cool that you never sweat. No, that was the worst thing ever. I could never sweat. It's because I was so toxic. And we had no idea at this particular point in our journey that we were supposed to have our channels open.
Is it your belief that it's important before you begin a kill protocol that you get your detox channels open? Again, and we can be blunt about it. There's never too much information on Tick Boot Camp, right? You have to pee, you have to poop, you have to sweat, right? Okay. And you have to, and there are a lot of different ways of doing that. But part of what you also have to do, because it's not just your vascular system that has to detox. And the good news is we have a heart, so we're pumping those microbes through. But we have another system, Claire, that we have to make sure that they're detoxing. Without movement, it's very difficult to do that. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so we have our lymphatic system as well that, you know, we don't have our blood is pumped through our heart, right? And the lymphatic system doesn't have a pump. So you got to make sure that you are pumping your own lymphatic system in a sense. And so we laugh about this now because we did the dorkiest little exercises and we called it the 5-minute energy routine. And I hated it because I couldn't even do it. I was so sick. But it's literally like, you know, bringing your knee to your hand. Like it's literally like the silliest little exercises that I couldn't do. Or like we had a rebounder. And so mom would be like, I know you can't jump. So just kind of like shake on it. Because we were so sick and we had to do all these little exercises. And I was like, why is this so hard? Like these little movements are impossible. And I didn't have any sense of balance. My energies were not crossing over correctly. I just was just a total mess. And so, but we had to do it. And mom made sure every day, even though she was sick too, that I got up, I did my 5-minute energy routine so that I could get my lymphatic system working. And we did it. It was just routine. We all did it together. Like every morning we woke up in the morning, we ate really gross oatmeal for breakfast because that's all we could eat. We took like a handful of pills and then we would do our energy routine and then we would read the Bible. And that's what we did every morning. And then I would conk out and go to sleep for like the next 5 hours. And that was my life for like 2 years.
All right. Well, but that, let's talk about the importance of sleep as well, right? Because there's another system, which is our, you know, our neurological system also has to have a detox protocol. And we know that the only way to do that is to get deep sleep, right? If we do not get deep sleep, then we can't detox neurologically. So talk to us about, Leanne, the importance of deep sleep and how you were able to put yourself and your daughter in a position where you were getting that element of detox in line.
Okay, well, yeah, that was a big issue for me for the first year. In fact, there were months where I don't think I got more than 2 or 3 hours of sleep at night. And that was really hard for my husband because he's trying to be the caregiver and then you're not sleeping and he doesn't know what to do for you. And he's totally exhausted himself and doesn't know what to do. So, So yeah, so you have to, one of the things that you got to learn even about sleep is that both your brain and your liver need to detox too. So your liver is your biggest filter, and you could be having problems sleeping because your liver isn't filtering right. So one of my biggest symptoms was that my liver enzymes were off the charts at the beginning of this, which is a sign that your liver is backed up. And we didn't know anything about liver detox, so we started doing castor oil packs, and I still do castor oil packs. They're great. They're awesome. In fact, when I'm herxing now, if I have a flare or something like that, a lot of times I know it's my liver because for one thing, they took my gallbladder out. So then that makes your liver have to work harder. So you need to be doing things to help your liver, and that's where herbs come in. So herbs, once we started to study on your own, and I got rid of the meds, the very first thing I did was I read all of Stephen Buter's books about Lyme disease and learned how to use the herbs. Because up until that time, I thought herbs were just something you put in your food, and I had no idea that they were for your health. We just hadn't ever been taught that. And so once you learn, there are lots of herbs that are so good to help you with liver cleansing, with that kind of thing. And then like castor oil packs are great. Movement's important. That is one of the first things that will help you with sleep. But then you need to understand that the things that are happening in our world right now are really trying to create your pineal gland to be calcified and your pineal gland to not function anymore. And if your pineal gland is not functioning, then you are not going to sleep, and you're not going to get deep sleep. So there's a couple things that you can do for that. And one thing is, if you're not dreaming, you probably don't have B vitamins, and that could be because you're not methylating. So you need to be having food-based good healthy supplements, and that's another subject that you got to be sure you're getting the right kinds of supplements that can, or herbs that will help you to methylate. And B vitamins are crucial for that. Tryptophan was one of the things that Stephen Buhner teaches, that tryptophan is huge for helping neurological Lyme. And that was a big game changer for us. That helped us with sleep. I got more results from tryptophan than I ever did melatonin. But I'm not saying melatonin isn't right either. For some people, the melatonin will work. The tryptophan is the precursor to melatonin. It's part of your methylation chain. And so tryptophan can help to calm you down, to I could take tryptophan during the day and it wouldn't make me sleepy, but it would help my body to relax. And that's one thing with Lyme, at least my Lyme, my body was always tense. It was always tremoring. It was always in fight or flight. And tryptophan was a big, huge part of that. And not watching stuff on your computer late at night. That's all the wireless stuff plays a big role in our sleep now.
Actually, that was a big part of sleep too, is that we kind of just formed this unspoken rule in our family that all of our phones go off at night and they go way somewhere, way far away from our rooms. None of us sleep with our phones on. We definitely don't sleep with our phones near our beds or in our rooms, because that keeps you awake at night, not staring at screens. Even just not having your phone in your pocket during the day, those were huge things that we implemented into our lives. And it's crazy because now I don't even dream of putting my phone in my pocket. I'm like, nope, that is, but nobody gets that because everyone puts it in their pocket.
So, Claire, let's distinguish the EMF issue from the light issue, right? Because
Yes.
we're talking about a lot of fundamentals here that I think are important to folks, right? So one of the things your mom was just talking about is the circadian rhythm, right? And one of the reasons why one of the things we need to be aware of as part of making sure we get deep sleep and making sure that we are getting sleep is that what triggers us to wake up is going to be light, right? And it's the blue yellow light distinction that's going to cause us to wake up. So it's very important for us to look at the sun coming up in the morning so that our circadian level rhythm is set. And then it's of course it's important to make sure that we're seeing the sun go down, because we're that distinction between the blue and yellow light is again going to be important for setting our circadian rhythm. But what we're doing to ourselves when we're looking at screens before we go to sleep is we're interfering with that rhythm, the circadian rhythm, and we're now waking ourselves up or changing the rhythm, right? So let's talk about the light first. And do you agree with the way I've outlined it and the importance of making sure that we're coming in contact with light appropriately, so that will help us with our sleep patterns?
Yes, definitely. And there's lots of things you could do to help with the light problem. So everybody's devices, your computer and your TVs and your phones, they all have a setting that you can turn off the blue light. I would recommend that for everybody, especially like for me, I'm a podcaster. I'm editing podcasts a lot these days. And so I just turned the blue light off on my computer. It's a desktop and it turned off really easily. And I don't even notice the difference in how the screen looks anymore. Okay, so just turn that off on your phone. It's the first big thing, and on all your devices. And then not staring at it at night, and honestly, not staring at your phone as much as you possibly can, because those are energy frequency devices that are very much sending us negative energies that are bringing our systems down. But you know, that gets more into the EMF part of it. There's blue light blocker glasses. I'd recommend that you get the right kind. Do your research on that, because I've gotten blue light blockers just from Amazon before that they almost make it worse. So make sure that you're doing your research on where to get your blue light blockers. There's lots of them that are really good.
And okay, remember, we have to be careful about when we're using the blockers as well, right? Because at nighttime, it's different than during the daytime than it is during the morning, right? So it's really as we're getting ready to go to bed, and as the light changes the hormones that will cause us ultimately be sleepy. And the tryptophan was one of the examples that your mom had given, right? It's one of the reasons why after Thanksgiving, we all get sleepy, right? Because turkey has a lot of tryptophan, and it helps us to have, you know, the proper hormonal, regulation to fall asleep, right? So light is an issue versus the EMFs and what impact the EMFs are having on our ability to sleep. So, and one of the things Claire is aware of, Leanne, that you may not be aware of, is that we at Tick Bootcamp have something called the Line Freedom Formula. And what we've learned from interviewing over 400 folks is that healing seems to take a pattern, right? We've identified these patterns, which we've now tried to create, turn into a formula. And what I'm hearing from you, Leanne, in particular, and I've heard this from Claire before, is that although you were on a very powerful treatment protocol, it actually probably came too early from the standpoint of the pattern, right? You have to go through a process of prehabilitation here at, we argue in Tick Bootcamp, where you have to get your body ready for what we call the assist phase or the kill phase. In the prehab, you have to get your diet right. You have to get your movement right. You have to get your sleep right. You have to get your detox protocol right, which also includes, by the way, social detox by getting away from people who are not necessarily healthy, and getting, you know, that to use Claire's term a little bit early, make sure we're around people who love us or loving us up, as opposed to the people who are draining energy out of us, right?
Right.
And then, so we call that the prehabilitation phase. Then we have our assist phase, where we're going through the kill, and it sounds like a good call. Then of course we have our rehabilitation phase, right? There is damage that's done to our bodies and our brains and our spirit as we're going through this journey. And then ultimately we have our maintenance phase, right? So we call that our Parm or Parmesan protocol. Matt and I are Italian, so we're always going to bring our Parmesan into our protocol. So, yeah, give me your reaction to the Parm framework, and whether you think that was consistent with what allowed you to go through your healing journey.
Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right. We went through. I was at the very beginning of the Lyme explosion of protocols. And so when I was at that point where I was learning that I had Lyme disease and even what that was, even after a lifetime of being sick, I was at the point where there wasn't a lot of information, but it was just about to take off with tons of information almost too much information for everybody, but nobody was really addressing detox yet. And so I think a lot of us were in this, well, we can do all these things, but when we do all these things, it makes us much worse. And so then we think, well, this can't be right. I mean, why are we getting so much worse? Why do we feel so terrible? If this is herxing, which is a healing crisis, then why does it feel like heck? You know, why do I feel so terrible? And that's why everybody needs to learn the process that you're talking about, because
Because
yeah,
we did it
we
backwards. Like, we
did.
did it so backwards, and like, it was like a roller coaster. And so, because of that, I don't know. Maybe that's one of the things that made our journey longer. I have no
But
idea.
it's also that conditioning that you're talking about, Rich, where we're taught that the doctor has this pill or this medicine for you, and it's going to get you well just like instantly, and it's going to make you better. And that the other way, you have to realize it took you a while before you got to this place where you were sick, and you don't even know what got you to that place. The doctors don't tell you what caused it in the first place. And so you know, you that everybody's skeptical, so everybody around you, and that's to your point, your last point, that if you are around people that are telling you that you're crazy for what you are doing and that you need to go back to the doctors, and I'm telling you, I had everybody tell me that. Why aren't you going to this doctor? Why aren't you going to that doctor? I have people come to my door and say, here, I knew this person who got well this way with this doctor, and this is where you need to go. And
Or we would tell our whole story and they would go, "Have you had a heart to heart with your doctor?" And we're like, "Did you just listen to us? Like,
and
what?"
so it's that brainwashing that makes you think that, okay, well, yeah, there must be something wrong with what we're doing, because this is a much longer journey, and this is a lot harder. But our bodies have an innate capacity to heal. But if you're taking a toxic body and you're filling it with more toxins, you're not going to get better. And that's why we got off the meds. But if you take a toxic body and you slowly go through the process of now opening up your channels, and yes, that can happen. It has happened for me. And so, am I completely well? No. And that's more to the story, but opening up your channels will start getting your organ systems to work right, because you're getting rid of the crud. And we're also living in a world now that is totally different. So when I was growing up, you could maybe detox, you know, every 3 months, every 6 months. You can't do that anymore. You now have to detox all the time, because we're in such a toxic world. And we've also outsourced. Moms used to know how to teach these things to their children. How do you detox? You know, how do you, what do, you know, when you have an illness, or what do? You don't stop a fever with Tylenol. You let the fever work its way through. But young mothers, including my generation, we outsourced everything, so we didn't learn, you know, traditional healing techniques. And so that's part of it.
Well,
Your
there's
mom.
also a fear element too, in that we're taught that we're so afraid of being sick and that we're gonna die. Your kid gets a fever, oh, they're gonna die. Oh, you know, we watch TV shows and movies where what's the first thing that always happens? Well, the mother dies from something. You know, we're just so conditioned to be afraid of these illnesses. And after what we've been through, like, my body can handle really intense pain. Like, I don't even know how I've lived through what I've lived through. I don't know how mom has lived through it. Our body can handle intense amounts of things. And sometimes it's just the body getting rid of junk, and it's part of the process. And when we know that, it's really comforting, because you're not going to die from that fever. That fever was put there by God so that you can detox. And so let it run its course. Once we start to realize those things, the fear element disappears, so we can actually fight this thing, and we can fight it with the weapons that God has given us to get rid of it, and we can heal.
And the system taught us all the wrong. It taught us wrong about all of that. Doctors are great for trauma, for accidents, for all that kind of thing. But the system never taught you the truth about how to have those things happen.
So then, one of the reasons why we call the second step in the outline assist is because we are uncomfortable with the concept of killing, right? And the reason we don't like killing is it's suggesting that our body is not going to heal itself. And because our body's not going to heal itself, we have to have some kind of pharmacological intervention in order to be able to ultimately overcome the microbes that are overwhelming our immune system. But in fact, we argue that it's actually assist, that you have to find ways of assisting your immune system, because your immune system is going to win the battle, or it's not, right? So it really has to be a sea change or a mindset change where it's not a pharmacological killing of the microbes, it's actually an assisting of the immune system. And if we're not going through the process of aiding our immune system in its antimicrobial function, then we're not going to get better.
Right. And in order to do that, you have to know root cause. So you got to know what's causing it. So for all of us, that's different. You can be living in a high EMF environment, that could be causing it. If you could have toxic relatives, that could be causing it. You could be taking, I know people that have been taking antidepressants for 20 years, 5, 6, 7, 8 antidepressants. And you don't think that that's not making you toxic, that's making you toxic. And so for everybody, it's different. And this is why the medical system doesn't work, because they come in and you're a pathology or you're an organ system, but we're not just one pathology. We're not just one organ system. And so you've got to know what root cause in order to assist. So you got to know where's the Lyme gone in your body? Where is it? And what's it doing to you? And how long's it been there? And what kind of environmental things are affecting it right now? And then when you get down to that level, and there are, to be honest, there are some really great people that are starting to see that this is the way medicine should be. You should sit with that person and talk to them and understand, you know, what are your triggers? What are your environmental factors? What are all those things? And then when you know that, then detox really isn't that bad. It might be bad at first because you're getting rid of a bunch of junk, but over time that will get better. And as your toxin level goes down, you'll start to have less pain and less problems.
So Claire, I want to talk to you a little bit more about energy and detox, right? Because, you know, one of the things that we've all said at different times, and I'm sorry to our listeners for my dog barking in the background, but we all know that there are some people that will come into a room and suck up all the energy in the room. So give us the social detox and how important that is, and the lessons that we've learned from, you know, just being in the presence of some people that will suck up all the energy in the room.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with something like chronic Lyme disease, you're dealing with something where you really do have to set your boundaries. And this was a lesson that was really, really hard for me, because I grew up in a culture where no matter how badly people treat you, you have to keep going to church and you have to keep being around them and you have to keep interacting with them. And I was just taught that that's what God wants you to do, no matter what. And so when all of a sudden I was faced with these people in my church community treating me really, really bad, and, you know, people not believing me and abandoning me, and, you know, mom experienced all the same things, if not worse than what I experienced, I didn't understand what to do about it, because I was taught that God wants us to forgive, and that means we have to keep hanging out with these same people and doing the same things with them and fulfilling our church callings. That's a big thing in the religion I was raised in. And what I learned is that it's okay to set boundaries. And when God revealed to me that it's okay to set boundaries and it's okay to say no to the people who are harming you on an emotional level, I was able to understand healing a lot better, because I realized that I don't have to hang around toxic people that are hurting me. And even if it is just somebody who really just drains the living daylights out of you, there probably is a root cause why they drain the living daylights out of you. And I wouldn't even recommend going to all the depth to figure out what that is in that person. Just put the distance between you and that person as much as you can. And, you know, life is situational. Sometimes it's really hard. I've had people I've had to work with that are just, it's my job. And I'm like, this is really hard. But don't be afraid to put the distance, and don't, my mom always says, don't let people into your vase room. So everybody has a vase room in their bodies where that's the special room. You don't let everybody into the special room. Don't let everybody into your heart. Don't tell people personal things about you if you don't really know that you can trust them. And that's a really hard thing to learn, and a lesson that I've had to learn over and over again that is really painful. And we can absolutely still forgive people without having to be around them all the time. In fact, sometimes the most loving thing we can do is let them go so that God can teach them what they need to teach them, because it's not our role. We're not God. We're not going to save them. And so don't be afraid to set those boundaries. to put distance between people that need to be have distance put between them. But then also, you can't just get rid of all the people in your life. You have to fill the hole. And so then interact with people who love you and who are treating you right and who are filling you up. And sometimes those people are really hard to find. Yeah, exactly. Who energize you. And sometimes those people are really hard to find. And so if you're in a place where you don't feel like you can find anybody, pray to God and ask him to send you people. And he will. And it will still be a rocky road, but he'll still send you the people that you need.
So, Leanne, share with us the rest of your treatment protocol after you went on your BX protocol and you had the successes that you had. You then sort of stepped back and you went through a prehab phase, maybe in reverse order. What else did you do, and how did you all get to the place where you are right now, where the both of you are looking beautifully healthy?
Well, the first thing that I have to not forget is that the BX protocol did help my husband almost get completely cured well. Yeah. And so his was different. Remember, I told you it was in his feet and he had swelling and all that. And so in his 50s, he was on crutches, not doing that well, and really trying to take care of us while he still was in pain. But then by the time he got done with BX protocol, then shortly after that, we moved to the farm, and my husband was bucking hay and climbing on things in his 60s, and he was doing things that he hadn't been able to do in his 50s. And so the BX protocol really did help him. But at that point, we were starting to think about moving. But before that happened, and that's when we moved out to the farm, which was another part of our healing journey, because the farm healed us. It healed Claire and my husband to really massively improving. But before that, I met somebody who was doing bioenergetic testing, bioresonance testing, whatever you want to call it, which was just helping you to find balance in the energetic body. And I had started learning the herbal protocol, so I'd start taking herbals, when she did this bioenergetic testing on it, which is it's Quest 4 testing, and there are Quest 4 test practitioners all around the country. You can find those. When she did that, it was like a game changer. It was as powerful as the energy catalyst that I'd gotten from the BX, but it was teaching me a lot about balancing the energetic body and how that would help your healing process. And so we all three actually went and got tested. And my husband goes, you know what? This is really great. You should learn this. I'm going to buy this machine right now for you and you can learn this. He goes, I'll learn acupressure, which my husband did. My husband learned acupressure to help me with my pain. He says, I'll learn the acupressure and you learn this. And there's a learning curve to this device. And I was, okay, great. Let's try something else. So we bought the device and I came home and there is a learning curve on this device. But my husband learned acupressure from Michael Gock. Michael Gock has an online acupressure course and it's absolutely fabulous. And my husband would learn how to do that. And that's how he helped me with pain. And then I began to learn bioenergetic testing. Basically, I was just doing it for the three of us because we all needed something. And it was amazing how learning how to balance the energetic body was helping us. But then we decided to move out of the city, that we felt like with lower electricity, because, you know, electricity was still bothering me.
It's also because we had been through so much trauma in that house. Like, we call it our sick house.
Yeah.
I remember moving out of that house and mom and dad being like, are you going to miss it? And I was like, heck no. Like, I don't want anything to do with that house. I don't think I would have survived another winter in that house because we had so much trauma. So just getting away was probably the best thing for us at the time.
So my husband, we get there, we find a place, and it's a beautiful place. And it was not what I expected at all, because it's a big place, but it was so well taken care of that three sick people could move there and still function. And my husband goes, Okay, I want to start an organic farm because now we need to eat organic. So if we're going to eat organic, then we got to grow our own stuff. So let's start an organic farm. So he did. This is just what drives my husband
And me and
is.
mom were still pretty sick, so we didn't have hired hands or anything. So dad's like, "We're gonna go plant the potatoes. Let's go plant the potatoes." And me and mom are like dying in the field, putting these potatoes in the ground. And I'm thinking, I don't ever want to be a farmer. This is miserable. Like I was pure city girl, and I'm thinking, why would I want to do this with my life?
Yeah, and we felt like Noah, like here we are, like Noah's Ark, like we're in the middle of this field and we feel like dying. And my husband's going, okay, I'll dig the holes. You drop the potatoes in. And we're going, okay.
And everyone around us is like, you can't grow in this town, right? The dirt's not good enough. You can't grow a garden here. And we're like, watch us. So we're gonna try anyway.
And he did. And I'll just tell you, the last 3 years, we've had this beautiful market garden farm. I mean, it's. We just have to show you pictures to have you. I really believe that three sick people could do this, but it was the out in the sun. My husband would say, I feel so much better out in the sun. I'm out in the sun, I'm sweating. He just felt like, he said, I feel so much better in my 60s than I ever felt in my 50s, and this is the way to go. For me, because of the trauma that you're talking about, Rich, that people gave me, I kind of spent some years just hiding inside because I going outside represented people, and I couldn't deal with people because they were so cruel to you who were sick. And I'm not the only one who has this story. After doing the Chronic Care Project, we know that many people have this story, but gradually, I was in charge of planting all this stuff. We plant all this stuff inside ourselves. It's all organic. We do it under lights. We put it out in the ground. It's all self done. And so I started being in charge of planting the seeds and doing that kind of thing. And then we wanted to get people to learn that that's foundational. If you don't change. Nothing that you can do with bioresonance scanning will help you at all if you don't change your diet and you don't have a good clean foundation in your diet. And so that's where it begins. And then came 2019, and that's when Chris Newby wrote her book. And so finally, I read her book. I said, now I know what the weapon is. So that was the weapon. Now remember it at the end of Isaiah 54, it's and no weapon formed against you will prosper, and every tongue that shall revile against you, thou shalt condemn. That's the heritage of the servants of the Lord. And so it was like the light went on, and it's like, okay, this is the weapon. I know this is the weapon. And so I started to take classes in bioenergetic training, and one of those doctors, well, first of all, I read all of Judy Mikovits's books. So she was teaching you about retroviruses, and she was teaching you about XMRV, leukemia virus, and all that. And she was blowing the whistle. A lot of people miscredited her, but it all made sense. It's like, oh my goodness, this is the mycoplasma connection because she's talking about that there was borrelia in the vaccines. There were pathogens in the vaccines. And so why is it that now we're seeing people all over the country with the Chronic Care Project that everybody in the family has Lyme, even the little tiny kids? And yes, can it be passed to kids? Yes. But is that the only thing? And so when I was doing the BX protocol, the big thing with my mycoplasma numbers, because he thought, the PhD thought that it was mycoplasma that was really important. So when I started to learn about the weapon, I started to take classes from Dr. Monzo. So I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. Monzo. Alfonso Monzo is he's spoken at the Red Pill Expo. He's been on Robert Scott Bell. He's taught a lot of things, but he's a naturopathic doctor that specialized in biophysics and bioelectromagnetic systems of the body. And he also earned degrees in biblical studies and Christian ministries. And so he developed a system that was called it's called the Alpha Top Body, which is a touch system kind
What's
of
it called, Leanne?
called it's called the Alpha Aleph Top Body. It's the Hebrew electromagnetic telecommunication system that your network in your body. And he believes that God taught him about this. So it's like a deeper system of acupressure. So acupressure points are real, but there are even deeper systems in our body that are based on the Hebrew alphabet, which is also numerical. And he began to teach this. And as he began to teach this, he began to teach about weaponized pathogens. And this is when he began to teach us that that basically the Armed Forces Institute, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and the Medical Research Foundation actually have published studies that show that they created ALS and lupus and Lyme, and they created it based on WMFI, which is weaponized mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, which was the original weaponized mycoplasma that they created to form a network in your body and to make you sick.
Let's pause that for a second, because I want to talk about the weaponization. One of the things that we've seen on our social media when we've discussed the weaponization of microbes is people will say, well, wait a minute, you know, the Lyme bacteria has been found in fossils millions of years ago. Wait a minute, you know, Etsy the Iceman had Lyme disease. How can you say that Lyme was created in a lab? So what would your response be to that, Leanne?
Okay, well, yeah, the bacterias, those are true and original bacterias that did exist. But when you weaponize something, what you're doing is you're taking it and you're adding many other things to it that are, you know, dangerous. I mean, this is what she talked about in her book. This is what the bioweapons part of our government. This is what
right.
they did. So,
that, so, so, the, so, the, so one of the things that Chris Newby taught was that the bioweapons element of research, for example, at World War II, was actually four times larger than the Manhattan Project, right? The Manhattan
yeah.
Project, of course, which is getting a lot of attention again now as a result of you know, some of the movies that have been produced about the Manhattan Project, but as it turns out, the bioweapons project, which was a more secretive project, was substantially larger than the nuclear weapons or the atomic bomb research, right? And
yeah,
but the other thing that Chris Newby taught was that the goal of bioweapons research is to paralyze communities of people. So if one person gets sick and then the family members have to take care of them and the medical care system is overwhelmed, what it does is it makes it easier for an invading force to come in. And how they do that is they don't create a new microbe. What they do is they make the current microbe more viral.
That's
so
right.
that your innate immune system can no longer protect you against the substantially more viral form of the same microbe, in this case, the same bacteria, right? So it's
That's
so
right.
when people are yelling at us and saying there's no way that it's a bioweapon, what they don't understand is we're not saying, or Chris Newby's research is not saying, that the bacteria was created. What she's saying is it was made more viral, and therefore it makes it more difficult for your body to prevent you from becoming chronically ill when you're exposed to this enhanced threat of a microbe.
Yeah, and they know that they didn't just make, well, I guess, yeah, in your terms, they made it more viral, but they added tons of bacteria, fungus, viruses to it. They added mercury, uranium, heavy metals like that to this, and that's how they've been weaponizing it. So a lot of doctors that I know that are the good guys that are really studying the truth, they will tell you that, you know, probably all of us have Lyme now, but what's the state of your immune system? Because how many weaponized pathogens have you been exposed to? And then I don't remember if Chris talked about nanotech, but that's a whole another subject, because that's part of the weaponization too, because they're using nanotechnology now in our food, in our water, in the skies, you know, and that nanotechnology has invaded all of our bodies. And so
Leah, let's talk a little bit more about it specifically as it relates to ticks and tick diseases, right? Because one of the things that Chris Newby also taught was that, you know, different species of ticks, can harbor a larger number of microbes, right? So one of the things that you taught us earlier in your testimony was that when you were first tested, when you and the vampire had taken, you know, 60 vials of blood out of you, what happened
26.
was 26. Okay, 26. I'm sorry, I'm being a little more dramatic.
I would have been dead after 60.
so the 26 vials where you had a little blood left in the system. What was happening was you were testing for a lot of other microbes that would not traditionally be thought of as tick diseases, right?
Yeah.
But what's happening is, as your immune system is overwhelmed by all the microbes that are being spit into you by an aggressive tick, what happens is you lose immune homeostasis, and all of these other bugs that were already in your system, for example, the Epstein-Barr, are no longer managed. And the reason it was testing so high for you is because those microbes were just taking off when they had otherwise been managed by your immune system, because your immune system is being overwhelmed by all of the tick microbes, right? So that's another one of the things that Chris Newby taught us, that you know, they were testing different ticks and putting multiple microbes inside of the tick to see if that was going to have an impact on our health. And then, of course, they were looking at more aggressive species of ticks. And here on Long Island, for example, you know, we have a number of different species, but there is, you know, the Lone Star tick is a very aggressive tick. It will actually come after you, right?
Yeah.
And so rather than just a questing tick that you have to come in contact with before it'll grab you, when the bioweapons researchers were doing research on ticks, they were actually using the Lone Star tick. And the Lone Star tick will literally come after you. And I've actually had on our social media, because I found Lone Star ticks on me repeatedly. They're all over the place here on Long Island. I had found a Lone Star tick on me, and I actually went up to my bathroom and put it on the bathroom sink. And then I turned to my phone, and the tick kept running at me. And I'd move it back, and it kept running at me, because they're an aggressive form of tick. So there are so many different elements of this. You know, of this this weaponization of not just the microbes, but also the vector or the tick that is being used to make us sick.
Yeah, and she talked about how they radiated them too. They exposed them to radiation too, and that's my point about my grandfather and going back. I mean, how long have they been doing this? Was it really just after World War II? Because if you go back to what I was talking about with my grandfather, they were testing long ago about Colorado tick fever and testing it on people. So if you already know that they have pathogens in them, why are you testing them on people? I mean, you must be testing something different, because why are you doing that when you already knew that back in 1930? So what are they doing? And so that's the thing about Lyme. So in my case, some of that happened to me when I got the shot in sixth grade. So and then I had many other exposures, but so you have to ask that question. You know, some people can get over it really fast, but how long have you had it? Where did it go? And this WMFI that they talk about, when they were creating it, they actually created it at certain levels. So they knew that if it was given to you at a certain level, it would develop into AIDS. If it was given to you at another level, it would develop into chronic fatigue. And they knew that as they were doing their studies. So for me, it just made so much sense, because with our disease, like, you'd get better. And this is what Dr. Monzo talks about too. If you've got a disease where you seem to get better, everything's fine, and then it comes back, and it almost feels for me, like there's something that powers back up again and starts over again. And how can that be? Well, if you understand the nanotechnology that they're using right now and the you know, the weaponized stuff and how they've done it, the technology has been there for a very long time. They have just not, they've hid that from us. And they've built into a system where we go and we fill our bodies with lots of toxins, and that nanotechnology works on the toxins that are already in your body.
Scary, scary stuff, Leanne. It is scary stuff. And we're actually at the 2 hour mark together. This conversation has been so enjoyable and time has flown by, but we generally wind down after 2 hours because our folks generally only have about a 2 hour attention span. So sure. It seems to me that we're going to have a part two of this sometime in the near future. Okay. So Leanne, why don't you talk to us now, as we wind down, about where you are today. How are you feeling today? And what are those things that you did that you think gave you the greatest gains that have gotten you to where you are today?
Well, I think that the first one is that you do, it's like what you guys are talking about. You've got to understand detox. You've got to understand what that means to you. And so in order to understand detox, you kind of understand root cause, you know, where is your body struggling? You know, what do you need to do about that so that you get your channels up and going so you can be eliminating your toxins. You can be doing those toxins. But in my mind, if you don't understand the weaponized piece of the puzzle, and this is, like you said, we'll have to have this conversation later on, but herbs and things like that, we're living in a different world. Herbs alone are not going to cut the weaponized stuff. You have to have other things. You have to understand the technology that's behind it and understand what to do about it. And there are some really, really great people. So before I go, I have to just say people should go to the Healing for the Ages with Dr. Artis and what he's done since COVID. Because he's teaching some huge pieces of the puzzle. And long haul COVID is very similar to Lyme. And so if you really listen to what he's discovering, and he's free to give this information on his site, then you can find some pieces to your puzzle. I know I have. So there are some good people out there, but you've got to understand that weaponized pathogens, this is not a normal situation. This is not, and our medical system was not set up to teach us anything about that. And so if you understand that piece and you understand what detox is and you understand that you need to learn, and Claire talked about this, you've got to take back your own healing power. Don't give that to a white coat. Don't give that to anybody else. Take back your own healing power, and there are good doctors out there trying to understand this, but the typical medical system is not there for you. And a lot of things that we've been taught by our government are exactly the wrong things to do. Throughout my entire life, almost everything I was taught, you know, don't eat any fat, you know, all these things that we were taught were all wrong. And so you really have to go back and understand what Claire was talking about, what's been outsourced, and stop outsourcing your personal health journey to somebody else and start learning that yourself. And there are good people out there trying to tell you the truth. So you just have to dig harder now to find those answers. Got to dig through the censorship, but they're out there. And then trust God. That's our journey. Trust God.
Amen.
Go talk to him, because he's never going to lie to you. And we've been lied to about a lot of things.
So the Tick Boot Camp always ends with a final question. And when Claire was on our podcast, the final question we would always ask is, what would happen if a loved one came into the room after the podcast and they showed you they were being bitten by a tick? What steps would you take to try to help them? And that was based on my journey and trying to improve the tick bite blueprint. And we use that for about 400 episodes, but now we have a new final question. So Claire, I'm going to ask you first, what are the three top low cost or no cost treatment options that you would recommend to folks in the community who are on a chronic Lyme disease journey?
Oh, that's such a good question. And there's so many answers to that, in all honesty. But my number one thing is exactly what Mom just said. Trust God, and lean into Him in the journey. That is the biggest thing that I've learned how to do. I take time every day to make sure I'm talking to God, checking in with God, asking Him my really big questions. And when you do that, He's the one who really enables us to heal on an emotional level, which is the thing that I still struggle with even the most. And the only thing that I've seen that really, really works is leaning into God and letting Him guide me to the trauma therapies that I need and the things that are helping me to get through that. So that's the first thing. I mean, it's free to go to God. He'll listen. He's there for you. Take time to be quiet and to hear His voice every single day. And when we seek for that, God is the greatest physician, and He will heal us as we seek for Him. So that's my first thing. My second thing is probably just take time to be in nature and to move your body. For me, I get a double whammy because I work on a farm, which is funny because I mentioned how much I hated farming when I first got here. But once I started and I realized how healthy the sun is at lifting heavy things is. And I mean, now I'm doing work like building chicken coops and butchering chickens and delivering goat babies into this world. And so now I'm doing work that is really intense farm work, and I love it. And so take time to be in nature and to move your body. Because for the most part, yeah, you can't start a farm for free, but you can move for free and you can be in the sunlight for free. And so take time to do that. And then my third thing would just be take time to laugh, and take time to laugh with the people that you love and that love you the most. Because when we're laughing in our house, in fact, we have joked about how much we just crack jokes about illness, which is so inappropriate when you think about it. Like, you can't crack jokes about illness unless you have an illness, right? But that's what we do. And I always say, I'm just the comic relief in our family. Mom's the science. I'm just the comic relief. That's what I got. And so take time to laugh. It's really healing, and it will heal your heart and your body.
All right. So Leanna, I'm going to let you end the podcast with your top three. And now you could actually either buttress the one, two, or three that Clara's given, or you can give us three more.
Oh, you know, it's hard to beat what Clara said, because that's what I believe too. The first thing I would say is turn to God. And I mean, that's what He did for me. He kind of gave me some signposts as to what direction to go. And people will say, well, why'd you go on this? I mean, why did it take so long? Why'd you have to go through such horrors? Well, because if you'd taken all away early, I never would have learned any of these things that I've learned. And that in itself can change you. Your deepest trials can change you, and that's what it says in Hebrews. It says, you know, He gives you better things through your troubles, through your adversities, and so that you can be made perfect through your adversities. And if we never had any of those, we become selfish and prideful, and we wouldn't learn anything. And so turn to Him, eat clean, learn what that means. It's harder than ever now. I feel for young families, because eat clean, drink clean water, check your water, find out what it means to clean your water, because we're just living in a totally different world. And young moms, I would say, take back your power. You have the power to help your children to heal. Start learning what some of these interventions are doing to your kids. Start learning what these things are. And take back your power to have healthy children, because our future depends on that. And so you've got to learn what God gave us. He gave us some incredible things. Like if my kids got bit by a tick, and by the way, if I took a tick into my doctor, he wouldn't do anything. He wouldn't have it looked at or anything. So herbal antibiotics are terrific. They're powerful. Learn what needs to be in your herbal medicine cabinet so that you can help your kids, because you're facing some totally different things than we faced. And so you got to take back your power and know that God will give it to you if you seek it. So I guess that's it.
I thank you. That was really wonderful. I thank the two of you for serving us here at Tick Boot Camp in so many different ways. And I look forward to our next time together. But Claire, thank you very much for being you. Thank you for bringing your mom and introducing your mom to our community. Leanne, thank you for taking so much time away from your beautiful family to share your beautiful journey with our community here at Tick Boot Camp.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.